on the essential few investment opportunities and says no to the many, merely good ones. Some believe the relationship between efforts and results is even less linear, following what scientists call a power law. According to the power law theory, certain efforts actually produce exponentially better results than others. For example, as Nathan Myhrvold, the former chief technology officer for Microsoft, has said, and then confirmed to me in person, the top software developers are more productive than average software developers, not by a factor of 10 times or 100 times or even 1,000 times, but by 10,000 times. It may be an exaggeration, but it still makes the point that certain efforts produce exponentially better results than others. The overwhelming reality is we live in a world where almost everything is worthless and a very few things are exceptionally valuable. As John Maxwell has written, you cannot overestimate the unimportance of practically everything. A non-essentialist thinks almost everything is essential. An essentialist thinks almost everything is non-essential. As we unlearn the one-to-one logic, we begin to see the value in pursuing the way of the essentialist. We discover how even the many good opportunities we pursue are often far less valuable than the few truly great ones. Once we understand this, we start scanning our environment for those vital few and eagerly eliminate the trivial many. Only then can we say no to good opportunities and say yes to truly great ones. This is why an essentialist takes the time to explore all his options. The extra investment is justified because some things are so much more important that they repay the effort invested in finding those things tenfold. An essentialist, in other words, discerns more so he can do less. A non-essentialist thinks almost everything is essential. An essentialist thinks almost everything is non-essential. A non-essentialist views opportunities as basically equal. An essentialist distinguishes the vital few from the trivial many. Many capable people are kept from getting to the next level of contribution because they can't let go of the belief that everything is important. But an essentialist has learned to tell the difference between what is truly important and everything else. To practice this essentialist skill, we can start at a simple level. And once it becomes second nature for everyday decisions, we can begin to apply it to bigger and broader areas of our personal and professional lives. To master it fully will require a massive shift in thinking. But it can be done. Chapter 4. Trade-off. Which problem do I want? Strategy is about making choices. Trade-offs. It's about deliberately choosing to be different. Michael Porter. Imagine you could go back to 1972 and invest a dollar in each company in the S&P 500. Which company would provide the largest return on your investment by 2002? Would it be GE, IBM, Intel? According to Money Magazine, and the analysis they initiated from Ned Davis Research, the answer is none of the above. The correct answer is Southwest Airlines. This is startling because the airline industry is notoriously bad at generating profits. Yet Southwest, led by Herb Kelleher, has consistently, year after year, produced amazing financial results. Herb's essentialist approach to business is central to why. I once attended an event where Herb was interviewed about his business strategy. It was a great talk in many ways, but when he began to talk about how deliberate he was about the trade-offs he had made at Southwest, my ears perked up. Rather than trying to fly to every destination, they had deliberately chosen to offer only point-to-point flights. Instead of jacking up prices to cover the cost of meals, he decided they would serve none. Instead of assigning seats in advance, they would let people choose them as they got on the plane. Instead of upselling their passengers on glitzy first-class service, they offered only coach. These trade-offs weren't made by default, but by design. Each and every one was made as part of a deliberate strategy to keep costs down. Did he run the risk of alienating customers who wanted the broader range of destinations, the choice to purchase overpriced meals and so forth? Yes. but Kelleher was totally clear about what the company was, a low-cost airline, and what they were not, and his trade-offs reflected as much. It was an example of his essentialist thinking at work when he said, "You have to look at every opportunity and say, well, no, I'm sorry. We're not going to do 1,000 different things that really won't contribute much to the end result we are trying to achieve." At first, Southwest was lambasted by critics, naysayers, and other non-essentialists who couldn't believe that this approach could possibly be successful. Who in their right mind would want to fly an airline that traveled only to certain places and didn't serve meals, no matter how cheap tickets were? Yet after a few years, it became clear Southwest was onto something. Competitors in the industry took notice of Southwest's soaring profits and started trying to imitate their approach. But instead of adopting Kelleher's essentialist approach, carte blanche, they did what Harvard Business School professor Michael Porter terms straddling their strategy. In the simplest terms, straddling means keeping your existing strategy intact while simultaneously also trying to adopt the strategy of a competitor. One of the most visible attempts at the time was made by Continental Airlines. They called their new point-to-point service Continental Light. Continental Light adopted some of Southwest's practices. They lowered their fares. They got rid of meals. They stopped their first-class service. They increased the frequency of departures. The problem was that because they were still hanging on to their existing business model, Continental Light accounted for only a small percentage of flights offered by the airline, they didn't have the operational efficiencies that would allow them to compete on price. So they were forced to skimp in other ways that ended up compromising the quality of their service. While Southwest had made conscious, deliberate trade-offs in key strategic areas, Continental was forced to sacrifice things around the margins that weren't part of a coherent strategy. According to Porter, a strategic position is not sustainable unless there are trade-offs with other positions. By trying to operate by two incompatible strategies, they started to undermine their ability to be competitive. The straddled strategy was enormously expensive for Continental. They lost hundreds of millions of dollars to delayed planes, and according to Porter, late flights and cancellations generated 1,000 complaints a day. The CEO was eventually fired. The moral of the story: ignoring the reality of trade-offs is a terrible strategy for organizations. It turns out to be a terrible strategy for people as well. Have you ever spent time with someone who is always trying to fit just one more thing in? Such people know that they have 10 minutes to get to a meeting that takes 10 minutes to walk to, but they still sit down to answer a couple of emails before they go. Or they agree to put together a report by Friday, even though they have another huge deadline that same day. Or maybe they promise to swing by their cousin's birthday party on Saturday night, even though they already have tickets to a show that starts at the exact same time. Their logic, which ignores the reality of trade-offs, is, "I can do both." The rather important problem is that this logic is false. Inevitably, they are late to the meeting. They miss one or both of their deadlines, or do a shoddy job on both projects, and they either don't make it to their cousin's celebration or miss the show. The reality is, saying yes to any opportunity by definition requires saying no to several others. Trade-offs are real in both our personal and our professional lives, and until we accept that reality, we'll be doomed to be just like Continental, stuck in a straddled strategy that forces us to make sacrifices on the margins by default that we might not have made by design. In an insightful op-ed for the New York Times, Erin Callan, the former CFO of Lehman Brothers, shared what she had sacrificed in making trade-offs by default. She wrote, "I didn't start out with the goal of devoting all of myself to my job. It crept in over time. Each year that went by, slight modifications became the new normal. First, I spent a half hour on Sunday organizing my email, to-do list, and calendar to make Monday morning easier. Then I was working a few hours on Sunday, then all day. My boundaries slipped away until work was all that was left." Her story demonstrates a critical truth. We can either make the hard choices for ourselves or allow others, whether our colleagues, our boss, or our customers, to decide for us. In my work, I've noticed that senior executives of companies are among the worst at accepting the reality of trade-offs. I recently spent some time with the CEO of a company in Silicon Valley valued at $40 billion. He shared with me the value statement of his organization, which he had just crafted and which he planned to announce to the whole company. But when he shared it, I cringed. We value passion, innovation, execution, and leadership. One of several problems with the list is, who doesn't value these things? Another problem is that this tells employees nothing about what the company values most. It says nothing about what choices employees should be making when these values are at odds. This is similarly true when companies claim that their mission is to serve all stakeholders, clients, employees, shareholders, equally. To say they value equally everyone they interact with leaves management with no clear guidance on what to do when faced with trade-offs between the people they serve. Contrast this with how Johnson & Johnson bounced back from the tragic cyanide murder scandal in 1982. At the time, Johnson & Johnson owned 37% of the market and Tylenol was their most profitable product. Then reports surfaced that 7 people had died after taking Tylenol. It was later discovered that these bottles had been tampered with. How should Johnson & Johnson respond? The question was a complicated one. Was their primary responsibility to ensure the safety of their customers by immediately pulling all Tylenol products off drugstore shelves? Was their first priority to do PR damage control to keep shareholders from dumping their stock? Or was it their duty to console and compensate the families of the victims first and foremost? Fortunately for them, they had the Credo, a statement written in 1943 by then-chairman Robert Wood Johnson, that is literally carved in stone at Johnson & Johnson headquarters. Unlike most corporate mission statements, the Credo actually lists the constituents of the company in priority order. Customers are first, shareholders are last. As a result, Johnson & Johnson swiftly decided to recall all Tylenol, even though it would have a massive impact, to the tune of $100 million, according to some reports, on their bottom line. The safety of customers or $100 million? Not an easy decision, but the Credo enabled a clearer sense of what was most essential. It enabled the tough trade-off to be made. We can try to avoid the reality of trade-offs, but we can't escape them. I once worked with an executive team that needed help with their prioritization. They were struggling to identify the top 5 projects they wanted their IT department to complete over the next fiscal year, and one of the managers was having a particularly hard time with it. She insisted on naming 18 top priority projects. I insisted that she choose 5. She took her list back to her team, and 2 weeks later they returned with a list she had managed to shorten by 1 single project. I always wondered what it was about that one lone project that didn't make the cut. By refusing to make trade-offs, she ended up spreading 5 projects worth of time and effort across 17 projects. Unsurprisingly, she did not get the results she wanted. Her logic had been, we can do it all. Obviously not. It is easy to see why it's so tempting to deny the reality of trade-offs. After all, by definition, a trade-off involves 2 things we want. Do you want more pay or more vacation time? Do you want to finish this next email or be on time to your meeting? Do you want it done faster or better? Obviously, when faced with the choice between 2 things we want, the preferred answer is yes to both. But as much as we'd like to, we simply cannot have it all. A non-essentialist approaches every trade-off by asking, how can I do both? Essentialists ask the tougher but ultimately more liberating question, which problem do I want? An essentialist makes trade-offs deliberately. She acts for herself rather than waiting to be acted upon. As economist Thomas Sowell wrote, there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. Jim Collins, the author of the business classic Good to Great, was once told by Peter Drucker that he could either build a great company or build great ideas, but not both. Jim chose ideas. As a result of this trade-off, there are still only 3 full-time employees in his company, yet his ideas have reached tens of millions of people through his writing. As painful as they can sometimes be, trade-offs represent a significant opportunity. By forcing us to weigh both options and strategically select the best one for us, we significantly increase our chance of achieving the outcome we want. Like Southwest, we can enjoy the success that results from making a consistent set of choices. I observed an example of this on a recent flight to Boston when I began chatting with 2 parents who were on their way to visit their son at Harvard. They were clearly proud their son was there, and I was curious about what strategy they and he had pursued in getting him accepted. They said, "We had him try out a lot of things, but as soon as it became clear an activity was not going to be his big thing, we discussed it and took him out of it." The point here is not that all parents should want their children to go to Harvard. The point is that these essentialist parents had consciously decided their goal was for their son to go to Harvard, and understood that that success required making strategic trade-offs. This logic holds true in our personal lives as well. When we were newlyweds, Anna and I met someone who had, as far as we could tell, an amazing marriage and family. We wanted to learn from him, so we asked him, "What's your secret?" One of the things he told us was that he and his wife had decided not to be part of any clubs. He didn't join the local lodge, she didn't join the book clubs. It wasn't that they had no interest in those things. It was simply that they made the trade-off to spend that time with their children. Over the years, their children had become their best friends, well worth the sacrifice of any friendships that they might have made on the golf course or over tattered copies of Anna Karenina. Essentialists see trade-offs as an inherent part of life, not as an inherently negative part of life. Instead of asking, "What do I have to give up?" they ask, "What do I want to go big on?" The cumulative impact of this small change in thinking can be profound. A non-essentialist thinks, "I can do both." An essentialist asks, "What is the trade-off I want to make?" A non-essentialist asks, "How can I do it all?" An essentialist asks, "What can I go big on?" In a piece called Laugh Kookaburra, published in The New Yorker, David Sedaris gives a humorous account of his experience touring the Australian bush. While hiking, his friend and guide for the day shares something that she heard in passing at a management class. "Imagine a 4-burner stove," she instructs the members of the party. "One burner represents your family, one is your friends, the third is your health, and the fourth is your work. In order to be successful, you have to cut off one of your burners. And in order to be really successful, you have to cut off 2. Of course, this was tongue-in-cheek. I'm not here to suggest that living the way of the essentialist requires us to decide between our families and our health and our work. What I am suggesting is that when faced with a decision where one option prioritizes family and another prioritizes friends, health, or work, we need to be prepared to ask, which problem do you want? Trade-offs are not something to be ignored or decried. They are something to be embraced and made deliberately, strategically, and thoughtfully. Explore. How can we discern the trivial many from the vital few? One paradox of essentialism is that essentialists actually explore more options than their non-essentialist counterparts. Non-essentialists get excited by virtually everything and thus react to everything. But because they are so busy pursuing every opportunity and idea, they actually explore less. The way of the essentialist, on the other hand, is to explore and evaluate a broad set of options before committing to any. Because essentialists will commit and go big on only the vital few ideas or activities, they explore more options at first to ensure they pick the right one later. In part 2, we will discuss 5 practices for exploring what is essential. The gravitational pull of non-essentialism can be so strong that it can be tempting to skip over or skim over this step. Yet this step in itself is essential to the disciplined pursuit of less. To discern what is truly essential, we need space to think, time to look and listen, permission to play, wisdom to sleep, and the discipline to apply highly selective criteria to the choices we make. Ironically, in a non-essentialist culture, these things, space, listening, playing, sleeping, and selecting, can be seen as trivial distractions. At best, they are considered nice to have. At worst, they are derided as evidence of weakness and wastefulness. We all know that highly ambitious or productive person who thinks, "Of course, I'd love to be able to set aside time on the calendar simply to think, but it's a luxury we can't afford right now." Or, "Play? Who has time to play? We are here to work." Or as one leader said to me in an onboarding process, "I hope you had a good night's sleep. You won't get much of that here." If you believe being overly busy and overextended is evidence of productivity, then you probably believe that creating space to explore, think, and reflect should be kept to a minimum. Yet these very activities are the antidote to the non-essential busyness that infects so many of us. Rather than trivial diversions, they are critical to distinguishing what is actually a trivial diversion from what is truly essential. Essentialists spend as much time as possible exploring, listening, debating, questioning, and thinking. But their exploration is not an end in itself. The purpose of the exploration is to discern the vital few from the trivial many. Chapter 5. Escape. The perks of being unavailable. Without great solitude, no serious work is possible. Pablo Picasso. Frank O'Brien is the founder of Conversations, a marketing services company based in New York that has been named to the Inc. 500 5000 list of America's fastest growing private companies. In response to the frenetic pace of today's workplace, he has initiated a radical practice. Once a month, he gathers each employee of his 50-person company into a room for a full day. Phones are prohibited. Email is outlawed. There is no agenda. The purpose of the meeting is simply to escape, to think, and to talk. Mind you, he doesn't hold this meeting on the middle Friday of the month, when productivity might be sluggish and people aren't getting any real work done anyway. He holds this day-long meeting on the first Monday of the month. The practice isn't just an internal discipline either. Even his clients know not to expect a response on this "do not call" Monday. He does this because he knows his people can't figure out what is essential if they're constantly on call. They need space to figure out what really matters. He wrote, "I think it's critical to set aside time to take a breath, look around, and think. You need that level of clarity in order to innovate and grow." Furthermore, he uses the meeting as a litmus test to alert him if employees are spending too much time on the non-essential. He says, "If somebody can't make the meeting because too much is going on, that tells me either we're doing something inefficiently or we need to hire more people." If his people are too busy to think, then they're too busy, period. We need space to escape in order to discern the essential few from the trivial many. Unfortunately, in our time-starved era, we don't get that space by default, only by design. One leader I worked with admitted to staying at a company 5 years too long. Why? Because he was so busy in the company, he didn't take time to decide whether he should be at the company. The demands of each day kept him from really stepping back to get perspective. Similarly, a senior vice president at a major global technology company told me he spends 35 hours every week in meetings. He is so consumed with these meetings, he cannot find even an hour a month to strategize about his own career, let alone how to take his organization to the next level. Instead of giving himself the space to talk and debate what is really going on and what really needs to happen, he squanders his time sitting through endless presentations and stuffy, cross-functional conversations where nothing is really decided. Before you can evaluate what is and isn't essential, you first need to explore your options. While non-essentialists automatically react to the latest idea, jump on the latest opportunity, or respond to the latest email, essentialists choose to create the space to explore and ponder. A non-essentialist is too busy doing to think about life. An essentialist creates space to escape and explore life. Space to design. The value of creating space to explore has been emphasized for me in my work with the D School at Stanford, officially the Hasso-Plattner Institute of Design at Stanford. The first thing I noticed when I walked into the room where I'd been asked to teach a course was the lack of traditional chairs. Instead, there are foam cubes you can sit on, rather uncomfortably, as I soon discovered. Like almost everything at the D School, this is done by design. In this case, the cubes are there so that after a few minutes of uncomfortable perching, students would rather stand up, walk around, and engage with one another, not just the classmates sitting to their right or to their left. And that is the point. The school has used the physical space to encourage new ways of engaging and thinking. To that end, the school has also created a hiding place called Booth Noir. This is a small room deliberately designed to fit only 1 to 3 people. It is windowless, soundproof, and deliberately free of distraction. It is, according to Scott Dorley and Scott Widhoft, in their book Make Space, beyond low tech, it's no tech. It's tucked away on the ground floor. It is not, as Dorley and Widhoft point out, on the way to anywhere else. The only reason you go there is to think. By creating space to think and focus, students can step back to see more clearly. For some reason, there is a false association with the word focus. As with choice, people tend to think of focus as a thing. Yes, focus is something we have, but focus is also something we do. In order to have focus, we need to escape to focus. When I say focus, I don't simply mean picking a question or possibility and thinking about it obsessively. I mean creating the space to explore 100 questions and possibilities. An essentialist focuses the way our eyes focus, not by fixating on something, but by constantly adjusting and adapting to the field of vision. On a recent meeting back at the D School, in another room with no seats or desks, but with whiteboards from floor to ceiling covered with post-its of every fathomable color, I met with Jeremy Utley. He is my partner in developing a new prototyped class that, in a moment of genius, Jeremy dubbed Designing Life Essentially. The sole purpose of the class is to create space for students to design their lives. Each week it gives them a scheduled excuse to think. They are forced to turn off their laptops and smartphones and instead to turn on the full power of their minds. They are given assignments to practice deliberately discerning the essential few from the many good. You don't have to be at the D School to practice these habits. We can all learn to create more space in our lives. Space to concentrate. One executive I know is intelligent and driven, but constantly distracted. At any given time, he will have Twitter, Gmail, Facebook, and multiple IM conversations going at once. In an effort to create a distraction-free space, he once tried to have his executive assistant pull all the internet cables on his computer. But he still found too many ways to get online. So when he was struggling to complete a particularly big project, he resorted to a desperate measure. He gave his phone away and went to a motel with no internet access. After 8 weeks of almost solitary confinement, he was able to get the project done. To me, it is a little sad that this executive was driven to such measures. Yet while his methods may have been extreme, I can't argue with his intention. He knew that making his highest point of contribution on a task required that he create the space for unencumbered thought. Think of Sir Isaac Newton. He spent 2 years working on what became Principia Mathematica, his famous writings on universal gravitation and the three laws of motion. This period of almost solitary confinement proved critical in what became a true breakthrough that shaped scientific thinking for the next 300 years. Richard S. Westphal has written, In the age of his celebrity, Newton was asked how he had discovered the law of universal gravitation. "By thinking on it continually," was the reply. What he thought on continually, which is to say exclusively or nearly exclusively. In other words, Newton created space for intense concentration, and this uninterrupted space enabled him to explore the essential elements of the universe. Inspired by Newton, I took a similar, if perhaps less extreme, approach to writing this book. I blocked off 8 hours a day to write from 5 a.m. to 1 p.m., 5 days a week. The basic rule was no email, no calls, no appointments, and no interruptions until after 1 p.m. I didn't always achieve it, but the discipline made a big difference. I set my email bounce back to explain that I was in monk mode until after the book was complete. It is difficult to overstate how much freedom I found in this approach. By creating space to explore, think, and write, I not only got my book done faster, but gained control over how I spent the rest of my time. It seems obvious, but when did you last take time out of your busy day simply to sit and think? I don't mean the 5 minutes during your morning commute you spent composing the day's to-do list, or the meeting you spent zoned out reflecting on how to approach another project you were working on. I'm talking about deliberately setting aside distraction-free time in a distraction-free space to do absolutely nothing other than think. This is, of course, more difficult today than ever in our gadget-filled, overstimulated world. One leader at Twitter once asked me, "Can you remember what it was like to be bored? It doesn't happen anymore." He's right. Just a few years ago, if you were stuck in the airport waiting for a delayed flight, or in the waiting room of a doctor's office, you probably just sat there, staring into space, feeling bored. Today, everyone waiting around in an airport or a waiting room is glued to their technology tools of choice. Of course, nobody likes to be bored. But by abolishing any chance of being bored, we have also lost the time we used to have to think and process. Here's another paradox for you. The faster and busier things get, the more we need to build thinking time into our schedule. And the noisier things get, the more we need to build quiet reflection spaces in which we can truly focus. No matter how busy you think you are, you can carve time and space to think out of your workday. Jeff Weiner, the CEO of LinkedIn, for example, schedules up to 2 hours of blank space on his calendar every day. He divides them into 30-minute increments, yet he schedules nothing. It is a simple practice he developed when back-to-back meetings left him with little time to process what was going on around him. At first it felt like an indulgence, a waste of time, but eventually he found it to be his single most valuable productivity tool. He sees it as the primary way he can ensure he is in charge of his own day instead of being at the mercy of it. As he explained to me, "I do recall one particular day where, by virtue of circumstances, I was either on conference calls or in meetings non-stop from 5 a.m. until 9 p.m. At the end of the day, I remember how frustrated I felt by the thought that I was not in control of my schedule that day. Rather, it was in control of me." However, that frustration immediately gave way to a sense of gratitude, given it was the only day I could recall feeling like that since taking my current role. In this space, he is able to think about the essential questions. What the company will look like in 3 to 5 years? What's the best way to improve an already popular product or address an unmet customer need? How to widen a competitive advantage or close a competitive gap? He also uses the space he creates to recharge himself emotionally. This allows him to shift between problem-solving mode and the coaching mode expected of him as a leader. For Jeff, creating space is more than a practice. It is part of a broader philosophy. He has seen the effects of the undisciplined pursuit of more on organizations and in the lives of executives. So for him, it's not a slogan or a buzz phrase. It is a philosophy. Space to read. We can take further inspiration from the example of Bill Gates, who regularly, and famously, takes a regular week off from his daily duties simply to think and read. I once attended a question and answer session with Bill at the headquarters of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in Seattle, Washington. By chance, he had just completed his latest Think Week. Though I had heard about this practice, what I didn't know was that it goes all the way back to the 1980s and that he stuck to it through the height of Microsoft's expansion. In other words, twice a year, during the busiest and most frenetic time in the company's history, he still created time and space to seclude himself for a week and do nothing but read articles. His record is 112. And books, study technology, and think about the bigger picture. Today he still takes the time away from the daily distractions of running his foundation to simply think. If setting aside a full week seems overwhelming or impossible, there are ways of putting a little think week into every day. One practice I've found useful is simply to read something from classic literature, not a blog or the newspaper or the latest beach novel, for the first 20 minutes of the day. Not only does this squash my previous tendency to check my email as soon as I wake up, it centers my day. It broadens my perspective and reminds me of themes and ideas that are essential enough to have withstood the test of time. My preference is for inspirational literature, though such a choice is a personal one. But for the interested, here are some to consider. Zen, The Reason of Unreason. The Wisdom of Confucius. The Torah. The Holy Bible. Tao, To Know and Not Be Knowing. The Meaning of the Glorious Quran, An Explanatory Translation. As a Man Thinketh. The Essential Gandhi. Walden, or Life in the Woods. The Book of Mormon. The Meditations of Marcus Aurelius. And the Upanishads. There are a myriad of options. Just make sure to select something that was written before our hyperconnected era and yet seems timeless. Such writings can challenge our assumptions about what really matters. Whether you can invest 2 hours a day, 2 weeks a year, or even just 5 minutes every morning, it is important to make space to escape in your busy life. Chapter 6. Look. See what really matters. Where is the knowledge we have lost in information? T.S. Eliot. The late writer Nora Ephron is arguably best known for movies like Silkwood, Sleepless in Seattle, and When Harry Met Sally, each of which was nominated for an Academy Award. Ephron's success as a writer and screenwriter has a lot to do with her ability to capture the essence of a story, a skill she honed in her earlier career as a journalist. But for all her years in the high-octane world of journalism, the lesson that affected her most profoundly dates all the way back to her high school years. Charlie O. Sims taught a Journalism 101 class in Beverly Hills High School. He started the first day of the class Ephron attended much the same way any journalism teacher would, by explaining the concept of a lead. He explained that a lead contains the why, what, when, and who of the piece. It covers the essential information. Then he gave them their first assignment, write a lead to a story. Sims began by presenting the facts of the story. Kenneth L. Peters, the principal of Beverly Hills High School, announced today that the entire high school faculty will travel to Sacramento next Thursday for a colloquium in new teaching methods. Among the speakers will be anthropologist Margaret Mead, college president Dr. Robert Maynard Hutchins, and California Governor Edmund Pat Brown. The students hammered away on their manual typewriters, trying to keep up with the teacher's pace. Then they handed in their rapidly written leads. Each attempted to summarize the who, what, where, and why as succinctly as possible. Margaret Mead, Maynard Hutchins, and Governor Brown will address the faculty on next Thursday. The high school faculty will. Sims reviewed the students' leads and put them aside. He then informed them that they were all wrong. The lead to the story, he said, was, there will be no school Thursday. In that instant, Ephron recalls, I realized that journalism was not just about regurgitating the facts, but about figuring out the point. It wasn't enough to know the who, what, when and where. You had to understand what it meant and why it mattered. Efron added, "He taught me something that works just as well in life as it does in journalism. In every set of facts, something essential is hidden. And a good journalist knows that finding it involves exploring those pieces of information and figuring out the relationships between them. And my undergraduate degree is in journalism, so I take this seriously. It means making those relationships and connections explicit. It means constructing the whole from the sum of its parts and understanding how these different pieces come together to matter to anyone. The best journalists do not simply relay information. Their value is in discovering what really matters to people." Have you ever felt lost and unsure about what to focus on? Have you ever felt overwhelmed by all the information bombarding you and not sure what to make of it? Have you ever felt dizzy from the different requests coming at you and unable to figure out which are important and which are not? Have you ever missed the point to something in your work or at home and not realized your mistake until it was too late? If so, this next essentialist skill will be immensely valuable. The big picture. On December 29th, 1972, Eastern Airlines Flight 401 crashed into the Florida Everglades, killing over 100 passengers. It was the first ever crash of a wide-body aircraft and one of the worst airline crashes in U.S. history. The investigators were later shocked to discover that, in all vital ways, the plane had been in perfect working condition. So what went wrong? The Lockheed jet had been preparing to land when First Officer Albert Stockstill noticed that the landing gear indicator, a tiny green light that signals the nose gear is locked down, hadn't lit up. Yet the nose gear was locked. The problem was the indicator light, not the gear function. While the officers were hyper-focused on the gear indicator, however, they failed to notice that the autopilot had been deactivated until it was too late. In other words, the nose gear didn't cause the disaster, the crew's losing sight of the bigger problem, the altitude of the plane, did. Being a journalist of your own life will force you to stop hyper-focusing on all the minor details and see the bigger picture. You can apply the skills of a journalist no matter what field you are in. You can even apply them to your personal life. By training yourself to look for the lead, you will suddenly find yourself able to see what you have missed. You'll be able to do more than simply see the dots of each day. You'll also connect them to see the trends. Instead of just reacting to the facts, you'll be able to focus on the larger issues that really matter. Filter for the fascinating. We know instinctively that we cannot explore every single piece of information we encounter in our lives. Discerning what is essential to explore requires us to be disciplined in how we scan and filter all the competing and conflicting facts, options, and opinions constantly vying for our attention. Recently, I chatted with Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist and award-winning journalist, about how to filter the essential information from the non-essential noise. Before I met with him, he had been at a lunch meeting with sources for a column he was writing. Someone at lunch thought, at first, that he was not paying attention to the banter at the table. But he was listening. He was taking in the whole conversation at the table. He was simply filtering out everything other than those things that really grabbed his attention. Then he tried to connect the dots by asking lots of questions only about what had just piqued his interest. The best journalists, as Friedman shared later with me, listen for what others do not hear. At the lunch, he had been listening for what was being said only at the periphery. He was listening more for what was not being said. Essentialists are powerful observers and listeners. Knowing that the reality of trade-offs means they can't possibly pay attention to everything, they listen deliberately for what is not being explicitly stated. They read between the lines. Or as Hermione Granger of Harry Potter fame, an unlikely essentialist I'll grant you, but an essentialist in this regard all the same, puts it, "Actually, I'm highly logical, which allows me to look past extraneous detail and perceive clearly that which others overlook." Non-essentialists listen too, but they listen while preparing to say something. They get distracted by extraneous noise. They hyper-focus on inconsequential details. They hear the loudest voice, but they get the wrong message. In their eagerness to react, they miss the point. As a result, they may, using a metaphor from C.S. Lewis, run around with fire extinguishers in times of flood. They miss the lead. A non-essentialist pays attention to the loudest voice. An essentialist pays attention to the signal in the noise. A non-essentialist hears everything being said. An essentialist hears what is not being said. A non-essentialist is overwhelmed by all the information. An essentialist scans to find the essence of the information. In the chaos of the modern workplace, with so many loud voices all around us pulling us in many directions, it is more important now than ever that we learn to resist the siren song of distraction and keep our eyes and ears peeled for the headlines. Here are a few ways to tap into your inner journalist. Keep a journal. Stating the obvious, the words journal and journalist come from the same root word. A journalist is, in the word's most literal sense, someone who writes a journal. Therefore, one of the most obvious and yet powerful ways to become a journalist of our own lives is simply to keep a journal. The sad reality is that we humans are forgetful creatures. I would even go so far as to say shockingly forgetful. Don't believe me? You can test this theory right now by trying to recall from memory what you ate for dinner 2 weeks ago on Thursday. Or ask yourself what meetings you attended 3 weeks ago on Monday. If you are like most people, you will draw a total blank on this exercise. Think of a journal as like a storage device for backing up our brain's faulty hard drive. As someone once said to me, the faintest pencil is better than the strongest memory. For the last 10 years now, I have kept a journal, using a counterintuitive yet effective method. It is simply this. I write less than I feel like writing. Typically, when people start to keep a journal, they write pages the first day. Then by the second day, the prospect of writing so much is daunting, and they procrastinate or abandon the exercise. So apply the principle of less but better to your journal. Restrain yourself from writing more until daily journaling has become a habit. I also suggest that once every 90 days or so, you take an hour to read your journal entries from that period. But don't be overly focused on the details, like the budget meeting 3 weeks ago or last Thursday's pasta dinner. Instead, focus on the broader patterns or trends. Capture the headline. Look for the lead in your day, your week, your life. Small, incremental changes are hard to see in the moment, but over time can have a huge cumulative effect. Get out into the field. Jane Chen was one of a team of students in a D-School class called Design for Extreme Affordability. The class challenged them to design a baby incubator for 1% of the traditional $20,000 cost. According to Jane, in the developing world, 4 million low birth weight children die within the first 28 days because they don't have enough fat to regulate their body temperature. If they had raced into this as simply a cost problem, they would have produced an inexpensive electric incubator, a seemingly reasonable solution, but one that, as it turned out, would have failed to address the root of the problem. Instead, they took the time to find out what really mattered. They went to Nepal to see the challenge firsthand. That's when they discovered 80% of babies were born at home, not in the hospital, in rural villages with no electricity. Thus, the team's real challenge, it suddenly became clear, was to create something that did not require electricity at all. With that key insight, they began in earnest to solve the problem at hand. Eventually, Jane and three other teammates launched a non-profit company called Embrace and created the Embrace Nest, which uses a wax-like substance that is heated in water, then placed in the sleeping bag-like pod, where it can warm a baby for 6 hours or more. By getting out there and fully exploring the problem, they were able to better clarify the question and in turn to focus on the essential details that ultimately allowed them to make the highest contribution to the problem. Keep your eyes peeled for abnormal or unusual details. Maryam Seeman is an award-winning journalist from Lebanon. She recently completed a John S. Knight Journalism Fellowship at Stanford University, where she specialized in media innovation and design thinking. I asked her to share the secret tips of her trade based on her years of experience capturing the real story amid all of the surface noise. Her reaction was encouraging. She said finding the lead and spotting the essential information are skills that can be acquired. She said you need knowledge. Getting to the essence of a story takes a deep understanding of the topic, its context, its fit into the big picture, and its relationship to different fields. So she would read all the related news and try to spot the one piece of information that all others had missed or hadn't focused enough on. My goal, she said, was to understand the spiderweb of the story because that is what allowed me to spot any abnormal or unusual detail or behavior that didn't quite fit into the natural course of the story. It's crucial, Maryam says, to seek a different perspective on a given story, one that would shed the light on the topic in a fresh, different, or thought-provoking way. One trick she uses is role play. She puts herself in the shoes of all the main players in a story in order to better understand their motives, reasoning, and points of view. Clarify the question. Anyone who has watched skilled politicians being interviewed knows how well-trained they can be in not answering the question being asked. Evading hard questions can be tempting for all of us. Often it's easier to give a vague, blanket answer rather than to summon up the facts and information required to give a thoughtful, informed answer. Yet evasiveness only sends us down a non-essential spiral of further vagueness and misinformation. Clarifying the question is a way out of that cycle. Eli Cohen, Senior Vice President at Salesforce.com, was one member of a six-person team crammed into a hot hotel room at the normally tranquil Cavallo Point, overlooking the Golden Gate Bridge. For the next 3 hours, they would compete against five other teams in a business simulation. The task involved answering a series of questions about how they would handle hypothetical management situations. As the timer ticked, Eli's team was having trouble getting started. Each proposed answer spawned still more opinions and comments, and soon, what should have been a fairly straightforward problem-solving exercise had devolved into a sprawling, undisciplined debate. I was there to observe and coach the team, and after 15 minutes of this, I had to ask the team to stop. "What question are you trying to answer?" I asked them. Everyone paused awkwardly. Nobody had a response. Then someone made a comment about something else, and again the group went off on a tangent. I stepped in and posed my question again. And again. Eventually the team stopped and really thought about what goals they were trying to accomplish and what decisions really needed to be made to accomplish them. They stopped the side conversations. They waded through all the ideas and opinions that had been haphazardly thrown out, listening for the hidden themes and big ideas that connected them. Then, finally, they moved from a state of motion sickness to momentum. They settled on a plan of action, made the necessary decisions, and divided up responsibilities. Eli's team won by a landslide. Chapter 7. Play. Embrace the wisdom of your inner child. A little nonsense now and then is cherished by the wisest men. Roald Dahl. At the end of the classic musical, Mary Poppins, the gruff and joyless Mr. Banks arrives home, having been sacked, discharged, flung into the street. Yet he seems absolutely and uncharacteristically delighted. So delighted that one of the servants concludes he's gone off his crumpet. And even his son observes, "It doesn't sound like father." Indeed, his father is almost a new person as he presents his children with their mended kite and launches into the song, "Let's Go Fly a Kite." Freed from the dreary tedium of his job at the bank, Bank's inner child suddenly comes alive. The effect of his good cheer is magnificent, lifting the spirits of the whole house and infusing the previously melancholic Banks family with joy, camaraderie, and delight. Yes, it is a fictional story, but it illustrates the powerful effects of restoring play to our daily lives. The majority of us were not formally taught how to play when we were children. We picked it up naturally and instinctively. Picture a newborn baby's pure joy as a mother plays peekaboo. Think of a group of children unleashing their imaginations, playing make-believe games together. Imagine a child in a state of what Mihai Csikszentmihalyi calls flow, as he constructs his own mini-kingdom out of a bunch of old cardboard boxes. But then as we get older, something happens. We are introduced to the idea that play is trivial. Play is a waste of time. Play is unnecessary. Play is childish. Unfortunately, many of these negative messages come from the very place where imaginative play should be most encouraged, not stifled. The word school is derived from the Greek word schul, meaning leisure. Yet our modern school system, born in the Industrial Revolution, has removed the leisure and much of the pleasure out of learning. Sir Ken Robinson, who has made the study of creativity in schools his life's work, has observed that instead of fueling creativity through play, schools can actually kill it. We have sold ourselves into a fast food model of education, and it's impoverishing our spirit and our energies as much as fast food is depleting our physical bodies. Imagination is the source of every form of human achievement, and it's the one thing that I believe we are systematically jeopardizing in the way we educate our children and ourselves. In this, he is correct. This idea that play is trivial stays with us as we reach adulthood and only becomes more ingrained as we enter the workplace. Sadly, not only do far too few companies and organizations foster play, many unintentionally undermine it. True, some companies and executives give lip service to the value of play and sparking creativity, yet most still fail to create the kind of playful culture that sparks true exploration. None of this should surprise us. Modern corporations were born out of the Industrial Revolution, when their entire reason for being was to achieve efficiency in the mass production of goods. Furthermore, these early managers looked to the military, a rather less than playful entity, for their inspiration. Indeed, the language of the military is still strong in corporations today. We still often talk of employees being on the front lines, and the word company itself is a term for a military unit. While the industrial era is long behind us, these mores, structures, and systems continue to pervade most modern organizations. Play, which I would define as anything we do simply for the joy of doing rather than as a means to an end, whether it's flying a kite or listening to music or throwing around a baseball, might seem like a non-essential activity. Often it is treated that way, but in fact play is essential in many ways. Stuart Brown, the founder of the National Institute for Play, has studied what are called the play histories of some 6,000 individuals, and has concluded that play has the power to significantly improve everything, from personal health to relationships, to education, to organizations' ability to innovate. Play, he says, leads to brain plasticity, adaptability, and creativity. As he succinctly puts it, nothing fires up the brain like play. A non-essentialist thinks play is trivial. An essentialist knows play is essential. A non-essentialist thinks play is an unproductive waste of time. An essentialist knows play sparks exploration. A mind invited to play. The value of play in our lives can't be overstated. Studies from the animal kingdom reveal that play is so crucial to the development of key cognitive skills, it may even play a role in a species' survival. Bob Fagan, a researcher who spent 15 years studying the behavior of grizzly bears, discovered bears who played the most tended to survive the longest. When asked why, he said, "In a world continuously presenting unique challenges and ambiguity, play prepares these bears for a changing planet." Jak Panksepp, concluded something similar in Effective Neuroscience, The Foundations of Human and Animal Emotions, where he wrote, "One thing is certain, during play, animals are especially prone to behave in flexible and creative ways." Yet of all animal species, Stuart Brown writes, humans are